What are some practices to deal with ill will going repetitively toward one object? There's a few things that one can do. I'm assuming the object is probably animate. One of the reflections is that reflection on all beings are the owners of their karma, heirs to their karma, born of their karma, related to their karma, abide supported by their karma. Whatever they shall do for good or for ill, of that they will be the heir. So that if something has been very upsetting or conducive to ill will, and is directed toward a particular person, then that reflecting on that person, if they've done something actually really unskillfully, they have to reap the fruits of their karma. Of course, the contemplation encompasses oneself as well, in the sense that we have to reap the karma of kind of soaking ourselves in ill will and repetitively reinforcing that kind of mental state, perspective, feeling, and that that is shoring up the roots of suffering. So that's, to me, that's always been extremely useful dealing with ill will, because there's a tendency when we have ill will to justify the rants that we get going, and that somehow the object of our ill will is deserving of our aversion, and we justify that, and then we also overlook the fact that it actually, that we don't need to be doing anything just because we're upset and get wound up with ill will doesn't actually do anything to that person. It just affects us. Recollecting and paying attention to that. There's a trying to remember as this popped into my head or something. There's a teaching of Shantideva's in the guide to the Bodhisattva, and that something to the effect that if there's a solution to the problem, then why create difficulty around it? And then if there's not a solution to the problem, then why create difficulty around it? But somehow we get swept up in ill will, aversion, cranking out all sorts of views and opinions, ideas, neglect the fact that we're just cluttering up our minds and making ourselves miserable. We all found Ajahn Yatiko's comment on true insight shattering our beliefs pretty intriguing. I'm fairly certain that I'm millions of miles away from true insight, but what about those meditative moments when you go, oh, I've never thought about that before, but how true? Are these possibly akin to true insight? I think one of the things is you get those intuitive senses, you get that sense of some clarity arises, it's just like, oh, I never thought about that before. That's really true. It really rings true. It feels true. Those are the kind of things that build a certain confidence in the fact that, yeah, insight is possible. Understanding can dawn on us. We can actually see through the different delusions and confusions that we carry around. I'm confused about the distinctions between the third and fourth foundations. That's in the foundations of mindfulness. It seems like there's overlap. Some teachers put the hindrances under phenomena. Can you explain, please? the third hindrance is cittanupassana. Cittanupassana, satipatthana. Satipatthana, and the fourth one is the Dhammanupassana, Satipatthana. So those are in terms of citta being mind, then it's more around the state of the mind, in the sense that when the Buddha describes it, as I mentioned once or twice, so that knowing the mind with greed is the mind with greed, knowing the mind without greed is the mind without greed. So that the various, with greed, hatred, delusion, knowing the mind that's concentrated is concentrated, knowing the mind that's not concentrated is not concentrated, knowing the expanded mind as the expanded mind, knowing the contracted mind as a contracted. So it's more like the state of mind. The mind is experiencing a particular mood of the mind. The fourth foundation is Dhammanupassana, and it's translated in various ways. Phenomena is one. I think that Bhikkhu Bodhi is leaning to using phenomena as his standard translation for that one. And there's various mental objects. Ajahn Jeff translated as mental qualities. That's actually why it's really helpful having these different translators translating the Pali, because in many cases there isn't to one definitive translation, but by seeing how different translators translate a particular term, then you can get a kind of a feel for what it's pointing to, what the Buddha is pointing to. So mental qualities. And when the Buddha expands on that, say like in the Satipatthana Sutta, then there's the hindrances are one factor, so there's mental qualities. So the hindrances are one. And what it is pointing to is sometimes it's like that which is, and it's like, say, negative or obstructive, the hindrances. That which is neutral, say, like the khandhas, the aggregates of being, the six sense spheres, six sense bases, could be positive in the sense of the seven factors of enlightenment, eightfold path. So it's like there's this range of mental qualities that we can be attending to. Okay, Ajahn, a small window of anatta has opened. It is very fresh, light, and breezy. But the opening is small, and the rest of the window is caked with so much dirt and grime. I'm fearful that outside of the support of retreat, it could close. Even now, it feels like it is opening and closing. How to best proceed? Much gratitude. Best thing is not identifying, not claiming ownership over that insight, but to really take note of it. Pay attention to the feeling of it. What happens is one starts to move into worry and concern. How am I going to support this? How is it going to go? What's going to happen? And then scheming and projecting into the future of, well, I've got to do this and this and this and this and this. Getting an agenda, a program going. And then all of a sudden you feel it all shrinking and closing. So that paying attention to the feeling. And that's the encouragement. I remember one time Ajahn Chah, and it's an example that I've used and people have probably heard many times if they've been around me, that the image of Ajahn Chah using the glass of warm water and saying, you know, that in terms of language, you call it warm water in English, say, but then in Thai, it's something else. Say, in the northeast of Thailand, it's even something else again. Chinese, French, it's all different. And so you can't really actually rely on language to describe something. He said, but if you just stick your finger in the warm water, then you'll know what warm water is. He says, because Dhamma is not in the language of description. Dhamma is in the language of feeling. And that's what it's pointing to. So that we study and practice Dhamma so that we can feel what suffering is like, what cessation of suffering is like, what peace is like, what confusion is like. We can feeling it. So that feeling of what does it feel like to have an opening and a feel of anatta. And when one puts down that program of identification, the I, the me, the mine program, what does it feel like? Paying attention to that, because it's the feeling that will carry us through. I enjoyed the story of the healing green light used by the Thai Venerable you shared with us yesterday, and I also enjoyed the teachings of Ajahn Tate you shared this morning. But then I'm wondering if the very act of trying to quote-unquote heal this body or quote-unquote clarify and brighten this mind acts to pull the heart out of neutral and back into the world of grasping and desire. Could you please clarify this? The thing is you've got to do something. When you've got a range of options of doing something, then, healing the body and clarifying, brightening the mind, those are your fairly decent options. But the reality is that if it's approached with grasping and desire, then it'll create suffering, it'll perpetuate suffering, it'll create complications. So that it's the learning of how to apply attention and discernment in a way that is truly beneficial. Of course, the way one sees that, the way we learn, usually, is recognizing, oh wow, I did that, I had such a good intention, and here I am still suffering. So that's when one lets go, one pulls back, one adjusts the effort or the approach or the perspective, so that there can be a relinquishing, a non-clinging, a non-attachment. But it doesn't mean that one doesn't do anything. When the Buddha was, you think of the ultimate multitasker. The Buddha was great, did all sorts of things, but he didn't suffer. And then knowing the limits of what one can do, in the sense of that, you think of the story of the Buddha. I think it was two years before the Buddha passed away. Then there was, he had this very serious illness that he was able to suppress and overcome by applying the faculties of the mind and healed himself. And the Buddha was saying, yeah, it's not time yet. And it was a conscious choice. You see in the suttas where they say, what if I applied my mind in this way and the faculties and I healed that? There's still things to do. But also recognizing, there's limitations. And then there's a point where, this body isn't going to heal anymore. And you really have to let go. So it's like this learning how to apply oneself with non-grasping, non-clinging, either to action or non-action. Because that's the crux of it, is how to live with non-clinging as the foundation. Please explain enjoying a pleasant meditation versus hanging out blissfully with an angelic face. And at what point should a calm mind switch to insight practice? And when do you use the term awareness or mindfulness practice? Certainly the Buddha praised a pleasant abiding here and now, but similarly also recognizing the limits of that, and that there's a need to, as in the previous question, that there's a need to apply oneself to activity, action, responsibility, duty, and the duty could be either external or internal, so that the pleasant meditation is very useful for relaxing the body, relaxing the mind, clearing the mind, settling the heart. And then there's a point to that settling and that clarifying, in that we direct the attention towards an understanding and discernment as to what is it that really creates suffering, what is it that lays the foundation for liberation, what lays the foundation for penetration. So, of course, one needs to prod the mind, push the mind toward that insight mode. And then, so that's that sense of, at what point should the calm mind switch to insight practice? And on a certain level, there's a tendency to think, when the mind gets really calm, then I'll switch to insight practice. Or there's a certain should that sometimes we impose on that. As we read it in the text, we hear the teacher say, one uses the calm mind, so that we should make the mind really calm so that we can investigate clearly. The problem is that desire creeps in, and then you say, how calm is calm enough? And I said, I guess there must be calm enough, but maybe right now is not quite enough. It should be a bit more. And if it's the same desire mode that works with food or whatever indulgence that we have. And one can only gain some confidence through experimenting and sort of seeing, I need to use this calm mind directed towards investigation. And then one moves out of the calming, settling mode to reflection. Calmness falls apart, mind gets scattered, start proliferating all over the place. That wasn't the right time. Back to the drawing board. So that is through that experiment. And that's part of the investigation, is sort of seeing, and what works for oneself. Because sometimes the actual insight practice investigation is actually what makes the mind calm. That's definitely in the mix as well. And then the terms, in terms of awareness or mindfulness practice, it's kind of interchangeable. I tend to use it interchangeably because it, again, so that's more of a feeling tone of the using that quality of paying attention. There's a last line here I'm having trouble reading. I'll try to address it as best I can, although I don't quite. While sitting in the dining hall, the image of a square cushion dropping away from my solar plexus occurred. That brought the insight that I was neither inferior nor superior to others, as ego asserts, but we're all equal. The Buddha actually, like, if one takes that as a position, that's kind of a type of conceit as well. So they trying to hold the position that either one's inferior or equal or superior is a source of suffering, and it's a type of self-position that is, one, it's just not necessary. So that there's aspects of, in terms of when we think of equality or being equal, then we equally share the condition of birth, aging, and death. That's where we're all equal, in that we're in the same condition. I mean, it is really, I think, important to try to recognize how the mind is always trying to find some sort of comparison position in relationship to others. I mean, just that worry that one is inferior, or sort of the absolute clarity. that's completely true and real. But, you know, so all of that, which is, again, is that trying to find a position. So that allowing that all to drop away. And then if we think in terms of equality, it's more that we share the same circumstances of birth, aging, and death. We share the same circumstances of form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. We share that equally, all these aspects being subject to these realities. In Thailand, there's a very common way for the monks to begin a Dhamma talk, kind of like giving a little blessing and then welcoming everybody and addressing everybody as friends and relatives in birth, aging, and death. That's actually very sweet. In order to avoid any unpleasant feelings, I tend to be among the first ones in the food line. I don't really feel good about it, but I can't help it. Any suggestions would be appreciated. Well, just the fact that you've written it down is already, and that's a big deal, actually, I think. Or one recognizing it and seeing it, wanting to do something about it. Now, that in itself is the opening up and shining some light on it. Experimenting with hanging back a bit, just to sort of see, well, how does that affect the mind? Being able to, especially around food, we're always worried about getting what we like, getting it when we like it. There's a, I think it's in the Visuddhi Magga, I think it's in reference to Sariputta, where Sariputta would, going on alms round and receiving food and seeing the tendency to wanting a lot of food, really sort of bringing up that wish. Okay, just offer a little, just offer a little. Worrying about whether the food was going to be, wanting the food, and say, to be hot and delicious. Oh, just offer me cold food. just sort of making those kind of, going counter to what our desires tend to drag us. Generally, the effort that we put into trying to avoid unpleasant feelings is enough to generate enough unpleasant feelings to keep on going. So that sometimes just sort of, why do I have to avoid? What is the worry? What's the concern? Why is the fear of experiencing something unpleasant? There's something that comes to mind with food. I was an extremely picky eater as I was growing up. And when I was at Ajahn Chah's monastery, Ajahn Chah's monastery had the reputation of having some of the worst food anywhere. And one of the stretches that I was living with Ajahn Chah, and Ajahn Chah started eating vegetarian so that people would bring vegetarian food, and then the kitchen started making vegetarian food, and then when I got on that bandwagon real quick. I mean, part of it is I do prefer vegetarian food, but also there's a lot of strange food in Ubon, and from all sorts of different critters. And just to not have to deal with that was it was really worth it. And so for a long time, they bring there'd be vegetarian food, and then the numbers of monks who were eating vegetarian grew, and then it ended up, over a period of many months, sort of turned into one side of the dining hall was the vegetarians, and one was the meat eaters, and yeah, there was some competition there, and judgments going on. And then one day, Ajahn Chah is a very observant person, so that he probably saw that as this is not a good dynamic. And without any kind of announcement or unbeknownst to anybody, the cart comes over from the kitchen with all the food on it. Usually it's the vegetarian food used to come first. And the way it was done is many monks would come, and in those days you would... the volunteers would come and pass the food out, so you'd have to be thinking in terms of making sure it was divided up and it was, you know, as even and distributed as fairly as possible. That was also part of me working with my pickiness, was I would help distribute food and then come back to my bowl, and it used to be slopped all over, and there'd be things would be all out. Not the way I would put it in, anyway. But anyway, I could get up there to receive the food and lifting the lids, and it probably wasn't just me, but I'm sort of, hey, where's the vegetarian food? And Ajahn Chah just said, there's no more vegetarian food, it's all just food. Pass it all out. So then, okay, well, just adjust to that and work with that. Okay, go do that. And so it gets all passed out, and then go back and do the food contemplation, do the blessing, and then take the first mouthful of food and put it in my mouth. And sure enough, it was a frog curry. was just... And I said, oh man, I don't believe this. So that was the end of my sort of vegetarian days in that year. But yeah, sort of always trying to avoid unpleasant feeling. And I said, well, you set yourself up. How do Tibetan monks generate so much body heat to melt snow? I'd like to learn that and warm up this sometimes quite cold hall at night. See, that's how perception works, isn't it? I haven't had the perception of cold here yet. Anyway, I don't actually know how they do that. There's a whole technique, but it would be through the concentration, taking a nimitta, paying attention to the channels of energy in that body, and then using that to generate heat. There's a Thai monk that I know, and he's still alive. He'll be 116 this year. And he did these incredible tudongs, like for decades. Wandered, you know, as a wandering monk, and through Thailand and up into Burma, around into India and the holy places. And then he got interested in going to Tibet. He went and wandered up through the Himalayas into Tibet. And this probably was in 1920s, 1930s. He ended up walking all the way to Beijing. Years and years and years of wandering. I remember people asking him, what was it like going up into Tibet and going through the Himalayas? He said, it was cold. It was cold. But he must have also been generating heat as well. He was somebody who was extremely accomplished in... I mean, that's one of the, say, the effects of concentration, is that it can be applied to different things. What's the relationship between a deep insight experience, what's called Kensho in Zen, and stream entry? I don't know, and I'm not really qualified to sort of say very much, other than read a few books about Zen. I'm not very knowledgeable. I never had the opportunity to really speak with somebody who's steeped in Zen tradition, Zen practice, to be able to ask myself or hear from them. So probably best not to comment on it. Hypothetically, a meditator, through practice, gains an experiential understanding of the Four Noble Truths and is established in mindfulness and equanimity. Life is good, and the glass is half full. However, there isn't a belief in rebirth, and that suffering will end in this lifetime. Why should the meditator continue on the path? Well, I think one of the things with the Buddha's teaching, the Four Noble Truths are an experiential teaching. And it also, one of the epithets of the Dhamma is that it's leading, when we chant it, we chant leading inwards. It's a phrase that can be translated two ways, leading inwards or leading onwards. So that with that insight and experience will tend to lead one onwards. And so that you realize the possibility, what you're doing is you're starting to get an experiential confirmation or an insight into what is possible. And it continues to open up new vistas and new possibilities to continue. And one realizes that one part of the realization of possibilities is also sort of recognizing the limitation of one's own previous perspective or one's previous attachments and clinging. You realize, those start to fall away because one says, it feels so much better to drop that. And that is a spur and an inspiration, an encouragement to continue so that it continues to open up for one. For several months now, I've been trying to not get caught up in stories and just focus on the feelings. Every time I stop the story, the feeling seems to consistently stop as well, and I can no longer focus on it. What am I missing? Well, I think one of the things to do is to, one is seeing the kind of the danger in the stories, proliferations, additions that we add to it. But then, if the particular, the fact that one is missing or regretting or seeing the drawback in not being able to focus on the underlying feeling, then that in itself is a feeling of suffering. So to be able to explore that, because there's always some sort of feeling that we can be exploring. And sometimes, we try to, again, on a certain level, there's another story of what the feeling should actually be. So, we're wonderfully adept at complicating things. So to be able to, just going to that sense of, what is the actual experience? Is there some feeling of discontent, dissatisfaction, suffering? Is it pleasant? Is it unpleasant? And then exploring that, you'll find it'll take one to another area of investigation. What is the Pali word meaning not made of that? Non-fashioning, non-proliferation. A-T-A-N-M-A-Y-A-T-A. atamayata. To get it? I need to spell it again. Dear Ajahn, thank you for developing the wisdom to teach and the compassion to choose to teach. I trust we give you the opportunity to deepen your practice, especially of compassion and patience. The Buddha would be proud of you and of your decision to teach. Instead of living in that nice little cave in the beautiful forest, all peaceful and still, with metta, us sentient beings. It was actually Ajahn Chah. I was comfortably ensconced in a beautiful forest along the border of Laos, and the last thing I was thinking of was taking on responsibilities or teaching. In fact, I was quite, I'd have my antenna out to be able to avoid circumstances where I would have to teach. And then Ajahn Chah sort of sent word and said, come back, that you are going to be taking over as a senior monk at Wat Nanachat. You, that was it. And there was no... Could you speak about the importance of intention and volition as related to karma and to the story about the chicken who set the intention to lay in her eggs but didn't follow through? But the intention was not so much to lay in the eggs, the intention was may these eggs hatch but then didn't follow through with sitting on them. But anyway, that's the distinguishing characteristic of karma is volition and intention, in the sense that it's not so much the actual action itself that will determine a result, but that in conjunction with, and but primarily, the quality of the volition, the intention behind it is going to be conditioning the result of that action more than anything else, so that that's something that the Buddha emphasized in more than one place. And actually, it's just this karma is volition, the importance of that volition and intention in terms of our actions. And then with that chicken, it's sort of the even when we have a wish, or may this happen or that happen, we still need to put forth the effort in actually doing something. Are desire and craving interchangeable, the same thing? Can craving or desire exist without suffering? It's a very good question in the sense of, because in the English language, we don't really draw a distinction. But in the Pali language, the scriptural language, then in the structure of the Four Noble Truths, then the second one, the cause of suffering is desire. But it's a specific word, tanha. And tanha is the word for desire, and that tanha is always associated with greed, hatred, and delusion, or some form of defilement. So it's always going to cause suffering in some way, shape, or form. There's another word that's also translated as desire, and that's chanda. That's a broader word that has to be qualified so that in the five hindrances, sensual desire in the Pali language is kama chanda, so that desire for sensuality. So that's going to cause suffering. Whereas there's a set of teachings that the Buddha gave that are the four bases of accomplishment. It's in the 37 wings to awakening, or Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, and the four bases of success, four bases of accomplishment. The first one is chanda, desire. And when it's used in that context, then it has a positive connotation. It's something that is necessary. So that I'll oftentimes translate it as interest or motivation. But there is that, say, chanda as a desire to accomplish something, desire to apply oneself to something, having a motivation and interest, that chanda is necessary. And of course it's desirable and beneficial. There's also in the Pali language, it's like the word dhammachanda, desire for the dhamma. And that's wholesome, it's skillful. Kusala chanda, desire for the skillful or the wholesome. Again, so that desire is going to be a desire that exists without suffering or is moving towards cessation of suffering or ending suffering. So it's helpful to have a sense of the use of language. Sometimes it's so different in, and sometimes in English, to the meaning of what the Buddha is saying. What did the Buddha say about giving all your assets away? Well, he would say it would depend, in the sense that if one is a monastic, that's the appropriate thing to be doing. As a, say, a layperson living in the world, then the Buddha was extremely practical. Basically, whatever one is doing, don't be stupid, don't be dumb, you know, don't be overly idealistic and impractical. There are many, many teachings that the Buddha gives on generosity, on sharing, on how to use one's wealth skillfully, and the benefits that come from using it skillfully. But part of that is also looking after oneself, looking after one's family, looking after one's future, looking after others. It's in a bigger picture. So that, yeah, the Buddha never sort of advocated for everybody to give up everything. If one's a monastic, then it's a whole different story. As a monastic, well, that's part of our ethos, to be able to relinquish the means by which we can get what we want. I remember a senior monk once coming to the monastery, and he had some lay supporters with him, and I was receiving him, and then they wanted to offer me money. And he said, no, don't do that. Ajahn Chah's monks don't receive money personally, don't keep personal money. And he said, yeah, money for a monk is like having wings to fly. He said, this is from one of the Thai people, because it started written in Thai. Several years ago, I remember reading your little book, The Last Breath, your experience supporting a Thai Buddhist at the death chamber that's in San Quentin. What I was very impressed about reading this story was how someone who was facing the last hours of his life still had sati and clear consciousness, had practiced generosity, requested foods for the monk, being humble and kind. Would you mind telling us about Jay's mindfulness again? There's lots I could say about that. That's over 10 years ago now, and still a wonderful memory. Jay Siripong, he was executed in 1999, I think it was. Yeah, and he was extremely clear, and one of the things I remember, I mean, many things, but then was how concerned he was. One, how happy he was that I was there the first day, and then he was able to offer me a meal in prison. So I was able to have my meal in San Quentin. But then also how he really looked after people and then was very concerned that they were also able to listen to Dhamma. And both people who were his friends and his sister, and then also the prison guards, wanted to make sure that they had the opportunity to listen to Dhamma as well. And some of his questions were not so much about what he wanted to know, but what he wanted them to know. It was very sweet. And he was, yeah, he was very clear, he was very peaceful, right up to the, because he and I were in adjacent cells during the, about 6 hours, we were moved there 6 o'clock in the evening, and then the execution was at midnight. And then we're sort of locked in adjacent cells, and we could speak at the corner so that we were able to meditate, chant, have Dhamma discussion, and that's on the very last day. And then when the time came for him to be taken to the execution chamber, then and we're surrounded by guards the whole time. There's half a dozen guards posted, one watching him, one watching me, one in each corner, then two that are sort of circulating. But he was very relaxed, clear, and then he went out of his cell and then had to walk around the cell that I was in and then come out, and then the door was over here. And so he's walked around my cell, and then he just stopped just before passing me and just sort of gave a why and said, "I take my leave, Venerable Sir." And went. It was just, it was steady. It was really quite amazing.
In English?
No, he said, "La Guan Kam." La Guan Kam. Lately, I've gotten more involved in fighting for social justice, especially with the Occupy movement. It seems important in light of how messed up our system is. However, I'm finding it very difficult to keep any mindfulness or peace of mind, especially when menaced by police. Any suggestions? The first suggestion that comes to my mind is it's actually at the Occupy Wall Street movement and St. Paul's Cathedral in London. And all sorts of people came up and were talking and chatting, and it was quite wonderful. And then they asked if Ajahn Amo and I, if we would lead a meditation. They actually have a meditation tent set up. So their little shrine, a meditation tent, and so that we went in and led a meditation and then did some chanting. So I think that's something to actually bring to that if it's possible. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really important thing to be doing. It's also important to not get caught up in, and in general, the tenor of what I've been reading is that there has been a real focus on that peaceful, nonviolent protest of an unjust system. So to try to find ways to foster that, and I think that's that sense of if it's possible to set up a meditation tent, that'd be great. Get people meditating. Can you please tell us about dreams? Do they reveal our defilements? Do you have any interesting dream story? The Buddha talked about different types of dreams. I mean, there's some dreams that are revealing your defilements, there's some dreams that are actually, there's some kind of insight happening. There are some that are prophetic dreams. There are some dreams that are because you ate the wrong food. You know, there's this whole range of dreams, so that it's not just about defilements. An interesting dream story. In the West, we might be maybe not so tuned into our dreams, whereas for Thai people, generally, they're much more attuned to dreams. It plays an important role, and people talk about them. And anyway, there was a point in time many years ago when there was a really scrappy, disjointed biography of Ajahn Chah, and small, kind of scrappy, disjointed, small biography of Ajahn Chah that had been done. It wasn't particularly satisfying, so then a couple of the monks at Wat Nanachat decided some of this chronology doesn't seem right, some of the stories are really unclear, we should go and clear this up with Ajahn Chah, and we could get going on an English biography. So they go over and try to interview Ajahn Chah, and he wasn't wonderfully cooperative. But there was this one particular circumstance where they were quite unclear as to, because there was these different events that were referred to in the existing biography, and you know, was that one the point where, you know, he really understood the Dhamma, or was it maybe that one? And so then they went, asked Ajahn Chah, and said, at what point was it that you really had confidence and clarity that you were going to realize some major attainment, realization? And then he talked about these three dreams he had. And then the main monk who was collecting the information, so Ajahn Chah explained that to him, and he was sort of, no, we want to know what real event was that. You know, what really was it? Not some dream. And so that sense of Ajahn Chah said, yeah, this was a real event, that something really shifted in my mind. But this Western monk's perception was something different. Two questions about thought. Did I understand correctly that thought is sankhara, which is distinctive because of volition? It is clear that some thought is volitional, but what about the many random crazy thoughts that arise unbidden? So address that first. I mean, some of the, again, there's a whole sort of range and spread of the degree of volition and in the causal process, so that, you know, there's some places where, you know, it's hard to really distinguish. But what's most important is one starts to pay attention to the actual causes and conditions and that causal process, so that one can start to tease out, okay, well, what can I actually be applying volition towards in order to undermine or change the direction of that? And then how much karma is carried in thought? I've been observing what feels like results of past unmindful thoughts. Is the karmic charge neutralized through mindful awareness of unwholesome thought? Yes, absolutely. That's the one of the ways of kind of shifting that tendency, the direction. You know, we do things because we think of them first. We say things because it pops in the mind, we think of it. So that there's a lot of karmic potency in the thought process. Next question. Do neutral feelings equal equanimity? Not necessarily, because equanimity, you want to be coming back to what is equanimity translated from. So equanimity is translated from the word upekkha, and upekkha is one of the Brahma Viharas, so that it's one of these expansive, mature emotions. Equanimity or upekkha is also the last of the seven factors of enlightenment, so that it's like the high end of the scale, what you're trying to move towards, so that it's a very refined balance and equipoise, clarity, stability as part of that condition. So, yeah, not all neutral feelings are like that. So that recognizing that a neutral feeling can be kind of indifferent or nothing much happening. Okay. And do you have any news you can share about the relationship between Ajahn Brahm and the rest of the Sangha in the Ajahn Chah lineage? I heard that he was going to meet with some elder monks in England. Yes, that happened. And very friendly, warm, and friendly, warm, but still distant. So it's moving in the right direction. And similarly, we had Ajahn Brahm's vice abbot come and stay with us for a few days. Well, last month, I guess. That was very good. So that being able to be laying a foundation of, well, healing in some way.